Hey, this is Hojo, and you're listening to me on Baseball and Barbecue with my two best friends, my new best friends, Jeff and Leonard. So y'all enjoy it, okay?
Studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York. This is episode number 245 of Baseball and BBQ. I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen, and that guy over there is Leonard Hollywood Aberman. And we welcome you back to our podcast. Leonard, it's been a while.
I'm back, Jeff.
So for people who don't know, we released these two recent episodes. Len was in London. So we haven't been recording for 2 weeks, so it's good to see Leonard again.
It's good to see you, too. Yeah, we're pulling back the curtain because we knew that I was going to be away in England and in the Cotswolds section of England and London. It was a wonderful trip, but we made sure that the show did not skip a beat, that we had two episodes ready to go when I left. And that is just, I'm happy to say that we did that. And, but now, because we haven't been together in so long, Jeff, I got a lot of things to talk about. I got a laundry list. Are you ready?
Really? Go ahead, start. Go ahead with your laundry list.
All right. Well, first of all, before we get to the laundry list, we do have a couple of things to tell people. And that is, one, our guests for this episode of 245. So I'll tell everyone that the first guest is Andy Martino, who has written the book. And what a book. It is The Yankee Way, the untold inside story of the Brian Cashman era. And Jeff, whether you're a Yankee fan, a Met fan, a baseball fan, you're going to love this because it just gives you such insight into the team. You mentioned to Andy at one point, I believe, that we're not Yankee fans. I respect the Yankees and what they've done. This book might make me more of a Yankee fan.
Oh, God. We hope not. But it does go into how the Yankee world operates. And it is just a fantastic story, a fantastic book by Andy Martino. And you don't have to be a Yankee fan or a Met fan. A baseball fan is going to love this book.
Yeah, going to love it. And then you think, okay, that's great. Most podcasts, not ours, would have the guest. It would be over. But no. We've got the barbecue guest. And he does not disappoint, as we have Christopher French, who has Girl Dad Barbecue, and that's his handle. He's on TikTok and Instagram and Facebook and all over. And we talked to him all about barbecue, as well as a little bit of baseball talk.
Yeah. Okay. So definitely listen to that.
Yeah.
But Len, don't you have something to tell us?
I do. I'm going to tell you right now, and that is Bet Online is your number one source for all your sports betting needs this season. From baseball, golf, soccer, right to all the top fights in UFC, MMA, and boxing. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds and spreads while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to our online casino and get in on a game of blackjack or poker, or unwind with one of our over 150 slots games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Use promo code BLEAV. That's BLEAV for your 50% free bet credit on your first deposit up to $250. Bet Online, the game starts here. And Jeff, you know what? We mentioned soccer. Did you know that in England, it's not soccer, it's football?
Of course. If you watch Ted Lasso, we know that.
All right. So I said I had a laundry list. Part of that laundry list, I can't rant. We've established I can't rant, but I can make an observation. So I'm just going to tease that in between the two interviews, get ready for my observation. But let's start.
Looking forward to that.
So I mentioned that I was in England. A while back, a long while back, we had the husband and wife team behind Honey and Co. And they had just put out a cookbook called Honey and Smoke. And they have a restaurant in England, in London, called Honey and Smoke. And I ate there. Now, they weren't at the restaurant when I went there, so I didn't get to meet them. They're not paying for this endorsement, but I have to tell you, if you're over in London and you want a great meal, go to Honey and Smoke. It was delicious. So that's the first thing on the laundry list. Then one other thing is on my flight home, I flew Virgin Atlantic, and there were two movies. There were many movies, but there were two baseball-related movies that I highly recommend. The first, and as a fan of this show, you'll be familiar with it. It's called It Ain't Over. Jeff, we know It Ain't Over, right? It's the
Yogi Berra documentary.
Right. But then they had another documentary called The League. And it was an older documentary, but it was all about the Negro baseball leagues. And it had some of our former guests.
Oh.
Bob Kendrick.
Okay.
Looking dapper as always.
He always does.
He was in it. Andrea.
Williams.
Andrea Williams, who wrote the book on Effa Manley, was in it. As a matter of fact, there was voice recordings of Effa Manley in this. Willie Mays was in this. Satchel Paige was in this. And you saw a video of him in his later years speaking. And I believe that one of his daughters was in this. So I highly recommend you could find it on, I think you said you saw Amazon Prime, has it?
Amazon Prime has it. You have to rent it. 99 cents, though. So yeah. It's definitely worth it.
Yeah. It's worth the 99 cents. It's worth a lot more than that.
Yes.
It's called The League, especially with the fact that the Negro League baseball stats are now part of Major League Baseball. There's definitely a renewed interest for people who weren't familiar with it. It should definitely watch that. And I'm going to save my observation for in between interviews. So, Jeff, I leave it to you.
All right. Here is Andy Martino talking about his book, The Yankee Way. We met our next guest at the New York Baseball Scouts Dinner this past January, and we're very excited to speak to him today. Andy Martino has written about sports, culture, and entertainment, and has covered Major League Baseball for more than a decade. A former staff writer with the Philadelphia Inquirer and the New York Daily News, he is currently a reporter and analyst covering Major League Baseball for SNY Network. He's also the author of two books, Cheated, The Inside Story of the Astros Scandal and a Colorful History of Sign Stealing, and the book we're going to be talking about today, The Yankee Way, the inside story of the Brian Cashman era. Welcome to Baseball and BBQ, Andy Martino. Welcome, Andy.
Jeff, thanks for having me. I appreciate this.
Andy, I'm a Met fan, as you can see in my background, but this was a fascinating book. And anybody who thinks they know the inside of the Yankees, they really don't. This was an education, I got to tell you.
Well, that's so nice of you to say. And there's so much connection, you know, with the Yankees, as you read in the book, with the Yankees produced with their quote-unquote Yankee way in the 80s, has its tentacles. I'm at Citi Field right now. I cover both teams, getting ready to cover Mets game right now. And I just gave a copy of the book to Carlos Mendoza because he lived it. He came up in this system that was invented by the Yankees in player development in the 70s and 80s. And so it's I shouldn't say it's no less of a presence, but it's a strong presence in Met culture, the way the Yankees do baseball operations because of the manager they hired. And they're playing the Phillies, by the way, whose manager, Rob Thompson, also comes out of that. I'd like to think that there's something relevant there for more than just your dyed-in-the-wool Yankee fan, for sure. I appreciate you liking it.
Yes, and there's names in the book that you're going to recognize, but there's also names that I didn't recognize and who were very responsible for the success of the late 90s Yankees. And I'm talking about Ron Brand, Bill Livesley, Jack Butterfield, yeah. Mitch Lukiewicz.
Yeah, Mitch Lukiewicz. Yeah, yep, yep.
I mean, could you tell us about them, how they participate in structuring the Yankees?
Sure. Well, one of the motivations behind this book was that Brian Cashman has long said, you know, the story that's always told about the Yankees is wrong. And he means a number of things by that, but a large part of what he means is the narrative about Joe Torre, Gene Michael, Brian Cashman, whatever, like the names that we know. He doesn't want to take anything away from a Gene Michael, who was a mentor to him, but he doesn't feel that anything close to the full story has been told and the people haven't been given their due credit. The people that you mentioned developed so many ways that the Yankees continue to do business. For example, Bill Livesey, who you mentioned, someone who started working for the team from the University of Maine, baseball coach there in the late 70s, stayed there through 1995, developed a player profile system where he ranked the tools in order of importance for each position, right? So it's you know about the five-tool player, mm-hmm. and it used to be you add up those tools, divide them by five. Well, Livesey said, well, why do I need a catcher that can run? Why do I need a center fielder that can hit home runs? So the Yankees started really zeroing in the early 80s on what is important for each position. And this still is with them today in the way that, say, when they get away from it a little bit by putting a Luke Voit at first base, who is not much of a defender, they realize, no, our Yankee way is the fielding tool should be no worse than third in a first baseman's profile. Therefore, we need an Anthony Rizzo who can catch the ball. You saw, you know, this was you're a Met fan. This was an example, Jeff, of something with the Mets last year, because Billy Epler, the GM last year, came mm-hmm. up in this as well. See how widespread it is. And people said, maybe you should move Brett Beatty to left field. He said, no. A field tool needs to be, if Brett Beatty struggles at third, we're not putting him in left. Left is where you need a burner. Mm-hmm. Not every organization feels this way, but this is what the Yankees developed. Somebody like Bill Livesey did that. Mitch Lukiewicz is a player development executive who mentored Brian Cashman when Cashman was a young player development official in the late 80s, early 90s. Brian Sabian, who will one day be in the Hall of Fame for his time as GM of the Giants, obviously championship winning. He was involved in Yankee player development, drafting. He wore so many hats for that team in the 80s and early 90s. So to Cashman, actually, one of the more surprising things I learned in the reporting of this book is to him, the beginning of the end of the Yankee dynasty came in the year, this is going to surprise you, 1995, before they won a single championship in that run, because Steinbrenner had fired Livesey and Lukiewicz. Sabian had moved on to San Francisco. Showalter is part of this tradition. He was gone designing the Arizona Diamondbacks by then. Mm-hmm. So the reason that the Yankees sort of lost their way a little bit, relatively speaking, in the early 2000s to Cashman, the seeds of this were planted all the way back in 95 because of the key people that they lost who never got to enjoy the actual dynasty. And that was really interesting as a baseball nerd myself to learn how these traditions and how these beliefs that they still implement got started, and how it was through people that aren't in the documentaries, aren't usually told in the story, aren't usually honored at Yankee Stadium. And to me, that was fascinating to really find that out and talk to these people.
I see Len has joined us. So welcome, Len.
Hi, Andy. I am so sorry. New York traffic. You didn't write about that in the book, but that could be a whole book.
No, but I said it myself today in the Grand Central, so I understand.
It's crazy. So, but I was so excited to have you on. Jeff, you probably already asked Andy what prompted him to now write this book. Oh, you did not. Okay. Andy, you know, it's obviously this is a book that had to be written. You wrote it extremely well.
Oh, thank you.
And I was thinking as I'm reading it, this is great timing. Last year would have been great timing, maybe next year. So what is it like right now that prompted you to write it?
Oftentimes the seed of something comes out of what you were working on previously. And I'd written this book, Cheated, which was about the Houston Astros sign stealing. The Yankees were one of the primary victims of that because they feel that they had built their team up the right way and then hit in this brick wall of a team in Houston that was cheating. And in reporting that book, look, I'd always covered for a long time, I've covered the Yankees. Knew Cashman as a reporter. I've known his front office. But reporting that book, I got to know them even better and to understand their process a little better of how they built up that era, to understand people in that front office like Tim Nearing and Gene Afterman, who don't get a lot of publicity, but they're people who Cashman really relies on. And it was a thread of that book, which when I was looking for the next project, I thought, you know, I'd like to learn more about how these guys operate, because among other things, not just the success and the fame and the iconography of the New York Yankees, but the continuity. That's what really interested me, because as you know, Len, from reading the book, you know, Cashman told me, and he told me this story years ago as part of what interested me, when he got there in 86 as an intern, he used to have to transcribe the answering machine messages of every minor league manager telling him literally what happened in the game. Kevin Moss went 2-for-4 with a walk. He was followed by Mike Pagliarulo or whoever, who was 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. And that's how the major league front office got the information, what was going on in their affiliates. And I thought, geez, that's like the Stone Age compared to now. Now, just today, they MLB released a metric on bat speed, for example, to the 10th of a mile per hour. And you know now who in the Yankees and Mets has the best and worst bat speed. These things are unimaginable for when Cashman started. They have a continuity because of people that we were talking about just before you got on, Len, Bill Livesey, Gene Michael, Jack Butterfield, who were there from the, in Michael's case, the 60s. A lot of those guys got there in the 70s. There's no other organization that has that kind of continuity. So I thought that the Yankees were a vehicle to tell the story of the trajectory of the game and meant technology, scouting, how managers operate, all those kinds of things over these 4 or 5 decades. And the final piece to why now is that Cashman's been at it for so long that I think there's an imprecise sense around him that the end may not be imminent, but it's in sight at some point. It's not going to be indefinite, the time that he wants to do this job and will be doing this job. So it seemed like he's definitely got more years behind him than ahead of him as the GM of the Yankees. So why not approach him about seeing if he's in a mood to reflect back on that?
Yeah, it is very good timing. And I've got to tell you, the book is called The Yankee Way, The Untold Inside Story of the Brian Cashman Era. We're speaking with Andy Martino. There's a lot in there about before Brian Cashman got there. But for anyone who has, you know, wants to know what's going on with that team and what the history. Oh, you reveal some things that are just incredible. I mean, really just you really get behind what goes on. And it's a great book.
The goal is to find out things that you didn't know and that other people didn't know. So, you know, hopefully you do that in a couple of cases. But that's the fun part when you do what I do, is to uncover a little nugget that hadn't been told before.
You talk about the Stone Age where Cashman got there in 86, I believe, right?
Yes, that's right, 86.
Okay, so yeah, I remember the Stone Age because in 84, I was an intern for the Mets, obviously. Oh. Not as successful.
Wait, how come you're not the GM of the Mets?
Exactly. What?
For 30 years, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly.
What happens. Managed to make it work.
But Cashman got his internship, you know, through connections.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, in this day and age, in 2020s, you know, it's contacts and LinkedIn and everything, but he did it back then.
That's right. Brian Cashman's father, some people know this, some people don't. It's been written about a few times, but he's a Hall of Fame harness racing executive, horse breeder, executive at different racetracks. And one of those is Pompano Park in South Florida, where he got to know George Steinbrenner when the Yankees trained in Lauderdale. So there was a connection there. And it's funny because John Cashman, Brian's father, had just as mercurial of a relationship in some ways with the boss as Brian later did. And sometimes he'd sell him a horse that would lose, or he wouldn't give him a favorable pole position or something. And Steinbrenner would blow up on him and stop speaking to him. So by the time that his young son, Brian, arrived, John Cashman had plenty to advise about. Here's how you deal with this maniacal, in some cases, guy, because I've been dealing with him for years, falling in and out with George Steinbrenner. So yes, he did. And one thing that people like Brian Sabian, who were already there, complimented him on in interviews I did for the book, where they said Brian was a person of means. You know, there was a connection that he came from, but he got in there and he listened and he asked questions and he worked his butt off and he did it the right way, is one thing that is universally said. He had that connection, but then got to work.
One of the things that I don't know how long, you know, you're going to be with us, so I want to make sure that I hit on certain points. And there's something that I've said many times, you know, you have the Yankees with, you hear the core four all the time. And I always feel like it should be the core five, mm-hmm. because Bernie, is definitely should be in there. And you bring that up in the book. So I'm kind of giving myself a compliment.
You're right. And Cashman agrees with you. I think his line was, that's bullshit if it doesn't include Bernie, I think is what he said.
Right.
So there you go.
Yeah. And I agree with that. So, and another thing that you talk about in the book is the Jeter and A-Rod, I'll call it a relationship, more like a non-relationship.
Yeah, but, frenemies. How about that?
Exactly. So could you just talk a little bit about, it won't spoil it for anyone, but a little bit about that relationship.
Sure. I mean, these are two fascinating people with egos and insecurities and successes. And in some ways, I guess they were bound to clash. But, you know, guys who were friends in the 90s when they were both the hot young shortstops, but coming from very different backgrounds. Jeter had a very strict, stable family. A-Rod's father walked out on him when he was, I believe, 10 years old. When A-Rod, there's something in the book about him playing winter ball in the Dominican as a prospect who's about to make it. His dad reemerges now that he's about to make it and wants to have lunch with him. And Alex is crying at night. Meanwhile, Jeter had revealed subsequently that he had issues with trust because he would have friends, white friends, and growing up in Michigan, who would then later say that they had a problem with interracial marriages, which his parents were, and that gave him some trust issues. There's a lot there sort of before these guys even met, I guess, that sort of set them up. Jeter had trust issues with A-Rod. A-Rod had insecurity issues with Jeter. And when A-Rod got to the Yankees, he'd already, I guess, taken that insecurity and criticized Jeter a couple times very publicly, which made Jeter leery of him and had really impacted their once close friendship. And for Jeter's part, he wasn't warm enough. And Brian Cashman had contended he wasn't enough of a leader or a captain to be fully inclusive to A-Rod when he came in. And he didn't help that insecure superstar acclimate to being a Yankee. And he and Joe Torre were really kind of cold. And there was a caste system in that clubhouse during those years. Had you won a championship with the Yankees or not? In fact, Kenny Lofton and Gary Sheffield went to the front office and said, we think Joe Torre is racist. And the front office had to convince them, we think it's more that he's kind of prejudiced against people who didn't win rings with him. Jeter was on that other side of it, and they never let A-Rod in. And Cashman would say, we're trying to win here in 04, 05, 06, 07. You're the captain of everybody. But as Gene Afterman, the assistant GM, put it to me in this book, he said, we wanted Jeter to publicly support A-Rod, and that was just a bridge too far for him. You know, A-Rod had already criticized him. Jeter wasn't going to let him back in. And Reggie Jackson said, I don't want to mess up the quote, so I'll paraphrase. Basically, once you get on Jeter's bad side, you're never coming back.
Right.
And that's what happened. And it took until much later in life when he made a documentary just a few years ago where Jeter told that story about the friend who had a problem with interracial marriages. Jeter wasn't anywhere close to being able to put that together at that point in his life. And so he and Alex just, you know, they made a sort of uneasy alliance at times, but they never were as cohesive as the front office would have liked them to have been.
Yeah, kind of like what you mentioned, Reggie Jackson and Thurman Munson. But yeah, they made amends toward the end of Munson's life.
Exactly. Now, it helped. They won a championship the first year together. I'm sure that helped. Mm-hmm. I asked Reggie about that. It said, you guys have, it seems like a parallel, right? There were two magazine articles in which you came off not great. Then there was the established star, and you were coming in as the big free agent. And Reggie said it was similar to a point. But as you said, they've made peace. And Jeter and A-Rod work together now at Fox, and they make that work. And from what I hear, they get along all right in that. So it's not like enemies. That's why I think frenemies is probably the right term.
Yes. Let me ask you, going back to Bill Lively, I mean, that system that he had, he was instrumental in making Posada move from a position change from second base to catcher.
That's right. They would look at that player profile and say, okay, you don't have the attributes. Your tools don't fall in the right order for a shortstop. He didn't have, obviously, didn't have speed. He wasn't a guy who's going to have a good field tool as an infielder, but he had a good arm at that point in his life. He had good bat to ball skills and power. So Livesey says to him, if you don't like getting to the ball, I have a place where the ball comes to you, was sort of the pithy way to put it. And they took a guy who might have been a washout shortstop in another organization and said, no, your tools fit for catcher. Let's try that. And obviously you had a nearly a Hall of Fame career as a catcher for Posada, a key member of a dynasty. So that's one famous example of how that worked. Absolutely. Jim Leyritz is actually another guy who was a pretty successful major leaguer over a number of years, who started as a shortstop. They converted him to a catcher. Obviously, he ended up playing some outfield. But they could look at guys and say, rather than saying, no, you're not what we thought you were, saying, no, we're going to move you to this. And they converted a lot of guys in the 80s in that system and saved some careers that way, for sure.
You know, there was a little crafty way with Gene Michael was trying to move
Steve Sachs.
Steve Sachs, right. He planted the seed in there. And that was kind of the way they did it for
Danny Tartable.
Yeah.
Showalter was telling me about this. He used to really get a kick out of how Michael would be so. He called him Wiley, I think. Uh-huh. He'd say, like, oh, I'd be at the winter meetings with the White Sox GM. Be like, oh, yeah, I mean, I don't know. If you want to take a look at Sachs, we're not going to move him, but I don't know, whatever. And then the White Sox GM was like, well, wait a minute, would you move him? And meanwhile, stick Michael, because he was an all-time evaluator, he knew that Steve Sachs was just about to decline. And so I guess we think about just chew on that. And Showalter's going, that is a really what I can't remember exactly what he said. He baited. Oh, I know what he said. He said, hey, baited that fucking hook real good. That's what Buck said. And you know, Buck's sort of his own. He's got his own little folksy way about him in telling that kind of story. But yeah, they and Cashman learned that too, because then all those years later, A-Rod's not happy in Texas. They're sitting on the dais next to each other at the baseball writers' dinner. And Cashman says to A-Rod something like, that's too bad you never wanted to play third. You'd be a Yankee. They're like, well, what? You serious? It was kind of the same playbook.
Exactly. He learned from the best, absolutely. Yep.
And Gene Michael, what a talent evaluator. Like you said, I mean, Sachs had, I think he hit 301 that year. I'm just trying to remember from the book. And trades him to the White Sox?
Yeah, he got Melito Perez, Jack, maybe not McDowell on that deal, but yeah, he got right. players that were valuable to him.
Bob and Huckman, the next year? Does not have a good year, and within a couple of years, he's out of baseball. What a talent evaluator he was.
Dave Righetti knew exactly when to trade him in that same era. He was. And then when you look at the players, he knew who to hold on to. They traded away guys in the 90s to help supplement that dynasty, but they didn't trade the wrong guys, generally speaking. He knew to hang on to Pettit. He knew to hang on to Rivera. He knew to hang on to Bernie Williams. The boss was trying to trade Bernie Williams so often that one time he told Gene Michael, Steinbrenner did, call every team in the league. I want you to trade Bernie Williams. So Gene Michael calls every GM in the league, but he's like, so, you know, how's the wife? What's going on? What do you, you know? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, good talking to you. And then he tells George, I called every team. So he would actually have to be deceptive to not trade Bernie Williams. But he knew that that was a guy to keep. So, yeah, it was amazing. And I you'd always heard of him as a super scout. That's his rep. That's anyone who knows baseball knows Stick Michael, scout. So I was asking Billy Epler, who scouted his side, what does that mean? What did he actually do when he was scouting? And Billy would say it was amazing because he had this pad. He would lock in on every pitch. He'd make a little mark that was decipherable to him. And then he'd look up after a couple innings, say it was spring training and Andy Pettit's throwing a couple innings. He'd go, he's ready. Look at the swings. Look at the way he's mixing his pitches. Look at his mechanics. He's ready for the season. Or he'd be watching Andrew McCutchen in the on-deck circle and go, oh, watch the way he scrutinizes the pitcher from the on-deck circle. That guy knows how to concentrate on pitches. All kinds of things like that. But it's fascinating what he would see. So, yeah, it was amazing to learn about, because we hear those stories as uneducated eyes, and it just makes you see the game just a little tiny bit more clearly when you hear a story like that. I think you start to know what to watch for a little bit more, which obviously is like amazing for baseball fans like us to learn just a little piece of.
And didn't George want to get rid of or trade Rivera after 97 playoffs after Cleveland?
I believe that's right. And he wanted to trade him in 95 for Felix Fermin, who would replace Jeter. So that would have been a real, you know, doozy. Wow. but he would listen to, I mean, there were certain baseball people. He hired and fired a lot of people. But it's interesting because we're talking about Yankee continuity. He did know that he could trust the boss, that is, could trust Gene Michael, trust Cashman. He almost drove these people away, but he listened to a select few people and said, okay, fine, we'll put Jeter in there after all. All right, fine, we'll hold on to Rivera. And that was interesting, too, that there were a few guys, and the guys who were real lifers there, that could push back on the boss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what you bring up in the book is how it's kind of revisionist history, how everybody now all of a sudden, you know, loves George Steinbrenner and thinks he's the greatest thing. But at the time when he was suspended from baseball for the second time for the whole Howie Spira incident with Dave Winfield, which if people are, I cannot believe there'd be Yankee fans that wouldn't know about that, but it's in the book. It's very interesting. There was a that's when people wanted, they wanted George out. And that's when the Yankees got good again, because Gene Michael was in there. He didn't have anybody, you know, over his shoulder. That is really when the Yankees became good again.
That's right. And, you know, Steinbrenner inherited a core of Nettles, Munson, Guidry when he took over first time. They had the run in the 70s. He's suspended. Well, Gene Michael and Cashman and Livesey and Sabian, all these guys are assembling the next dynasty in the 90s. Now, in fairness, he had that aggressiveness, Gene Steinbrenner. He was a great recruiter. He could supplement a core like that with a Reggie Jackson, with a Catfish Hunter. You get into the 90s, he knew how to – I mean, Jason Giambi, even though he didn't win, turned out to be a good signing for the Yankees. He knew how to reel in the big fish, charm people, pushes people toward like, all right, we're building something. Now it's time to win. Those are his strengths. But right. You're absolutely right how unpopular he was because of – in the 80s, they won a lot of games, but it was going in the wrong direction, obviously, by 1990, which was a bad year for them. And when he suspended, Tony Kubek, who was in the booth at that time, says on the air that the Yankees should have a Howie Spira day. I mean, can you imagine that if Hal Steinbrenner got in trouble, like Paul O'Neill on Yes saying, like, well, thank God Hal's gone. It's crazy to think of how that dynamic was at that time and how that's how reviled George was. And then he comes back and they win. So he gets kind of a soft landing at the end of his career, which is a lot of why I think the current Yankee fan who is starved for the volume of championships that they're used to romanticizes George Steinbrenner now. Because he has had that success. Look, he's won more rings than Hal. Can't deny that. But the story, of course, of how and why and who actually made the decisions, and that gets more complicated.
Winning cures everything, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about Cashman and the fractured front office, because there was a Tampa area and a New York front office. And I was fascinated to read that the Yankees could have had Vladimir Guerrero, but they settled on Sheffield.
Cashman had Guerrero signed, just not inked, but, you know, agreed to terms. And George is like, no, you don't. And I signed Sheffield, who they lived in Tampa together. And Sheffield was a pretty good Yankee for a couple of years. But obviously, Guerrero's wearing the Angels hat in the Hall of Fame.
Exactly.
Which is where he obviously went instead. So that was one smaller things where they would – Steinbrenner or Cashman was trying to re-sign Miguel Cairo, a solid infielder. Steinbrenner signs Tony Womack instead. Cashman's like, I wasn't even talking to Womack's agent. What is this? So that's part of why Cashman actually quit after his deal was up in 05, because he goes, George, you need somebody who you trust, because this is not working. This is ridiculous. You're making these decisions and I'm getting blamed for them. And so that's when he really consolidated his power, Cashman did, because Steinbrenner, again, having that instinct for continuity when it was really needed, said, all right, do what you want to do. And he gave Cashman more power than he'd ever had, which it's ebbed and flowed because of various reasons over the years. But Cashman's basically held that full control over baseball operations ever since. But yeah, leading up to that in 05, the Yankees front office themselves never knew exactly who they were signing, who they were trading, who was talking to who. Steinbrenner had his people in Tampa, Cashman had his people in New York, and it was – by what they described, it was crazy and not sustainable. So they cleaned it up.
Yeah. And what Cashman did with after 98, he thought the Yankees were getting complacent. So he brought someone else in who had the fire to win another championship, brought in Roger Clemens, which it was a brilliant move. I mean, mm-hmm. Didn't like what happened with Piazza.
No, that was something. But I don't blame you. As a Met fan, I find that's a fascinating moment. Yeah. All these years later, even. And what I liked, the little thing I learned about that, which is just funny, was Omar Minaya and Jim Duquette in the front office at that time, our Mets front office, are screaming during that little moment where everyone was on the field confused to Lenny Harris to punch Roger Clemens. Because Clemens is all geeked up. He's going to hit you back. Right. And then he's out.
Right.
And all you did is lose Lenny. No offense to Lenny Harris, but you got Roger Clemens out of the game.
Exactly.
But that didn't happen, obviously. But yes, Cashman had that feel after his first year as GM. greatest team of all time, arguably, 98 Yankees. And he's thinking, we're not as hungry as we used to be. So he had this opportunity to trade the wildly popular David Wells, of course, for Roger Clemens. And just, you know, this guy is hungry for a title like we were before we got one. So even though Clemens didn't have a great year in that first year with them in 99, he became someone who they think was one of their all-time teammates, ended up winning a couple of rings with them, settling into becoming a very good Yankee. And that's a good example. That's a pretty bold move for a 30, 31-year-old general manager. You inherit a dynasty. I mean, he was part of the destruction of it, but you know what I mean. As GM, he inherited the dynasty. To shake it up like that at year one, but that's a move that he was confident in making, and it did work out.
And a little funny anecdote in there was Clemens used the icy hot on a certain part of his body, which I
yes, he
can't
did.
Believe that.
Yes, he did. Yep. Anyway, we know that now that Clemens was doing a lot of things that were common in that era. But I don't know if icy hot in a sensitive area to get you fired up. I don't know how common that was. That's something I've never tried. I don't know about you guys. I do my little workout without the icy hot on that area.
You know, what else is good is you never know when someone like for us, you know, we love baseball history, but we also were kids during a certain time. And you have people that, believe it or not, don't even remember the 90 champion, the 90s right. And the championships. But you go further. You have Aaron Judge in there. And so it's not that it stops there. It's all the way up to now. So even someone who's a Yankee fan that's, say, 10 years old or something, they'd even want to read this because there's something they can relate to.
Well, thanks. I hope so. My whole interest was to connect it all, right? To show how it all fits together. Right. So the Yankees trading Jordan Montgomery for Harrison Bader connects to a guy that was here in the 70s, and the ideas that he came up with about defense in center field, just as one example. Or how Aaron Judge as a leader is different from Derek Jeter and in many ways more inclusive as a captain. It's show that tradition and how it all connects. And that's why I wanted to bring it into the current day.
Let me ask you about Cashman's relationship with Jeter is now, I guess, is repaired. Because you talked in the beginning of the book how they met in Cooperstown. Back then, it was fractured. He told Jeter, go. If you can get a better deal, go.
Yeah.
But Jeter actually, you know, as being an owner, part owner, saw the other side.
That's right. In the hotel in Cooperstown, Cashman goes to pay his respects. So Jeter's getting inducted in 21. Jeter pulls him aside and says, I just want you to know I understand a little bit more now that I'm on the executive side and appreciate what you did for my career. And that meant a lot to Cashman. You know, there's a lot of water under the bridge there. They didn't immediately start like taking joint family vacations together or having monthly, you know, dates for lunch after that or something. But it meant something to Cashman to get that little bit of closure for sure. I mean, they're all older now. They both played a part in one of the great baseball epics of our time. And they have that connection. But these are two titanic figures, right? The architect of the team and the icon of that team. And maybe they were bound to clash because they had different roles within that, and definitely two guys who both had their own sense of self and pride and ideas. So they'll never be best friends, I'm sure, but they found a measure of peace with each other.
Mm-hmm. And Andy, you also Cashman, he's not afraid to, well, not be loved by the players. That's
right.
Certainly that comes out loud and clear in the book. And I guess as GM of the Yankees, that's a GM of any team, but he can't worry about whether he's loved, even by the fans. I mean, he can't worry about it, but certainly by the players.
Yeah, and that can't be fun. It's the easiest thing to do to go around and fist bump everyone and be liked, I guess. But he has those hard conversations with players. I mean, again, he's not, like you said, that's what GM's job is. But he's doing it in this fishbowl in New York for this many years, and his leadership style or communication style in that way is just be blunt. Tell Derek Jeter, like, hey man, you're not a shortstop anymore. He might hate you for saying it, but he's like, it's my job to say it. It's not my job to be your friend. Aaron Judge, who he likes as a leader, but there's this thing in the book about Judge trying to protect his teammates by throwing sunflower seeds at the yes cameraman. You'd show Gary Sanchez in a slump, and Judge didn't like that. So he's blocking the camera. He's throwing seeds at the camera guy. And Cashman's like, dude, you can't do that. The Yankees own this network. You can't intimidate the cameraman. Judge would go, well, I'm going to protect my teammate. So they're in this confrontation, or and that might be too strong a word, but, you know, they're having a difficult conversation, and that's what Cashman will always do. Other people that worked around him have been unbelievable, like have been shocked sometimes. We're like, I can't believe you just told that guy, like, we're trying to trade your ass or something. Like, how are you this open with people? But mm-hmm. that's what he feels is the easiest thing to do. You're in New York. If you lie to somebody, it'll get out. Just tell it like it is. And that's his communication strategy, basically. The same thing with the media. He doesn't lie to us. He isn't the most accessible. He will say, I wouldn't say, or I couldn't say. But if he says, no, we haven't had extension talks with Juan Soto, they haven't. His thing is, like, just tell the truth. If you're going to say anything, it's easier that way.
Absolutely. Lastly, and I know you have a game to cover, so we thank you for your time. I want to ask you two questions. How has Cashman's influenced the role of general manager in the sport of baseball? And what is his lasting legacy?
Great questions. His influence, well, I think he is part of that tradition that has that incredible web around the game. Like I said, Thompson managing against Mendoza tonight. That's not strictly Cashman, but, you know, he's a carrier of that torch. So the Yankee way is all over the game. His influence as an executive, boy, that's interesting. I think that in some ways he's more aggressive and more all in all the time than the current batch of executives. If you look at Jeff Luhnow's, the Houston general manager's coaching tree, Mike Elias, David Stearns, these are very rational, like probably guys that don't mind sometimes, hey, here's a season where we're going to take a step back. It makes sense. They're not wrong about these things necessarily, but Cashman's like trying to win all the time. And in some ways, that's like, I don't know if that's influential right now. I'm not sure that's how teams operate for the large part anymore. So maybe his way of doing things is almost an older way of doing things. It works for the Yankees and their fans because they're in it every year. But so his influence, I'm not sure, but his legacy is that his peers consider him. And I want to think about that influence question. It's a really good one that I haven't framed specifically. But I know that his legacy is someone who's regarded by his peers as perhaps the greatest to have ever done the job. And I was surprised when I first heard that from Billy Beane, who told me that. And Sabian said the same thing in a totally different interview where he didn't know that Beane had said it. Those two are very different executives, by the way. And they both came to that same conclusion. They look at what I just said, competing every year, over 500 for more than 30 years, that alone. And then the championships, the communication skills in New York. He's seen by his competitors as someone who just has the full package. And there's, I'm not saying they all feel this way, but there's some awe of like, wow, how are you doing this year in and year out? And that's definitely his legacy. And ultimately, his legacy will be that he'll be one of a very small handful of executives in Trine and Cooperstown.
Absolutely. And one last one for me is he done this from the 86 or so through today with the change of technology and the internet and cell phones and pictures everywhere. And he survived all that, where a lot of people would not have survived that.
How about that? Well, I think that goes with the transparency. Like, if you look at the Astros science ceiling scandal or the Phantom IL scandal that took down Epler with the Mets, Cashman's style with that is, he's explained this to me, it's not even an ethical thing so much as, I mean, the ethics are a nice byproduct of it, but it's like, if you're in New York and you do something you shouldn't be doing, cheat or whatever, it's going to come out. Someone's going to find out. If you do something scandalous, no, he's had a few things over the years. I mean, like he went through a divorce publicly and things like that. But basically, his MO has been that radical transparency thing, meaning if I do it, the world's going to find out about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that's kept him with his longevity, because it's true. The Mets did this little Phantom IL thing that, in the eyes of a lot of people around the game, wasn't even that big a deal. That got out.
Yeah.
The Yankees were messing around a little with the replay room stuff in the early days of that with the signs, but they never took it as far as the Astros. Again, not because they even claim to be these bastions of ethical behavior, but because like, we're going to get caught. That's if we do something. So let's not, you know, that's right. How he thinks.
Andy, you know, he's been with the team this long and you had another GM that maybe isn't greatest of all time, but he certainly loved in two cities, and that's Boston and Chicago, and that's Theo Epstein, who, you know, left Boston and goes to the Cubs and then brings them a world championship. Has Brian Cashman, do you think it's ever going to be a time that he leaves the Yankees and does, maybe he retires temporarily or something, but do you ever think that he has any kind of desire to go win a championship with another team?
Well, he's had those opportunities. The Dodgers offered him twice as much money back then in 05 when he thought to leave. The Mariners, the Phillies have pursued him. He was a fleeting possibility for the Mets around 2000 when Steve Phillips was on leave with a personal issue. And he's never been able to pull the trigger and leave. It's his dad. It's Steinbrenner. It's where he'd been his entire adult life. This is dyed-in-the-wool stuff for him. I'm not saying he would never leave, but if you look at his history, he's gotten close, and he's like, can't do it. I think it's more likely that he would spend – he's 56, I think, right now, 55, 56. More likely he would spend his 60s as some kind of senior advisor to a Hal Steinbrenner, something like that, than a GM for a different team. And I say that because he simply doesn't have – he has a whole track record of not being able to do that. I think he's a Yankee. So we'll see what happens, but I think he's more likely to manage a transition and then help in some way there.
He'll be like, you know, he'll be like Jeter. He'll be, but instead of a player, he'll be a GM that stayed with one team. I mean, to be an executive with the Yankees and stay without ever being fired, that is a huge accomplishment.
By George Steinbrenner, for God's sake. I mean, it is really remarkable.
Andy, thank you very much for joining us. The name of the book is The Yankee Way, The Untold Inside Story of the Brian Cashman Era. It is a fantastic book. Even if you're not a Yankee fan like us, go get this book. It's really very insightful, and it's just a terrific read. Very, very entertaining. Thank you, Andy, for joining us on Baseball and BBQ.
Well, thanks to both of you for taking the time to read it so closely and to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
All right. See ya.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast, and if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out, Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
Thank you very much, Andy. Jeff, are you a Yankee fan now?
No, but there are some great stories in there.
Phenomenal stories. Yeah, really great. Thanks again. Thank you to Andy. You know who else I want to thank, Jeff?
Who's that?
I want to thank baseballbbq.com.
Okay.
I want to thank them because they've come out with phenomenal grilling tools and accessories with baseball bat handles, cutting board shaped like baseball jerseys and home plate. You could get anything you want engraved on them. So I'd like to thank them because it gives me a great website to go to. It gives me a great gift. You know, when I need a gift for someone, if I'm going to a barbecue and I don't know what to bring them, I go on there, pick out a nice tool, get it engraved. It makes a great gift. So thank you, BBQ.com. Go to their site. But I have somebody else I want to thank.
Oh, yeah? Who's that?
Yeah. I want to thank Doug Scheiding.
Okay. Thank you, Doug.
Doug, we appreciate you listening to the show, being on the show, but especially I heard Doug on the Barbecue Central show with Greg Rempe. And he was talking about one of our former guests, Grubbs, James Grubbs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was talk about some things that James Grubbs said in an interview. Doug mentioned that he had heard those in an interview. And I think Greg said to him, oh, where did you hear that interview? And Doug said, the Baseball and Barbecue podcast. So I want to thank Doug because I had forgotten that Grubbs had said it. So I appreciate the reminder. And I also appreciate that Doug brought up the show. So, Doug, we appreciate you. Thanks.
And you know, Len, you weren't on the only one who was away last week. I took a long weekend trip.
Yes, you did.
I went to Cleveland. You know, Cleveland rocks.
Cleveland rocks. Okay, I won't sing, but
thank you.
Go ahead.
I went to this Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Great place. Really loved it. And also took in a gardening game. And I went with the guys from the Baseball PhD podcast who treated us very, very well and had a great time. And if you want to listen to the latest edition of the Baseball PhD podcast, yours truly is on it, the one that's titled the Milwaukee Brewers. Check it out. You'll hear yours truly in studio with those
guys. Yes, in studio, speaking with them. Jeff, I was actually nervous that when I got back from my trip, you were going to say, sorry, Len, but I'm defecting. I'm leaving you and joining them. But you did not, and I'm very grateful for that.
So I want to thank Ed, Mark, and Farley for hosting us. So thank you very much.
Very good. Jeff, is it time for my observation?
Yes.
You know, baseball now, I guess it's on ESPN, when the game's on ESPN, the Sunday night game, has a new thing. I guess they did it last season or whatever, of interviewing a player in the game as they're playing. The player has an earpiece, and as they're playing, they're speaking to them. They're asking them questions, and the player is there. I saw, I forget who it was, in the outfield a couple weeks ago being interviewed. They kept positioning themselves, and as they're positioning themselves, they're being asked questions. Okay. The latest one was the Mets were playing on a Sunday night game. I think they were playing the Cubs. Pete Alonso, playing first base, he's being interviewed. Now, I know people were like, oh, the questions that were asked because the whole grimace thing and all that, but we won't even go there. But they're asking him questions. He's moving around. He's trying to field his position, and he has to think of the answers to these questions. Okay. Some people say, oh, it's good for the game. Other people say, what if he makes a costly error? But I thought about it. Here's my observation. We should interview these people for the podcast while they're playing. Why not?
Why not? I tell one good reason why not.
Go ahead.
They're paid $10,000 to do those interviews.
Okay. So we'll ask for donations. We'll get $10,000 and we'll do an interview. What's the difference? They're being interviewed by ESPN. Let's interview them for the show. You know what, Jeff? Let's take it a step further.
So if you want to make a donation, our address is.
let's do this. Maybe the players should be able to take phone calls from home. Like I see Francisco Lindor at shortstop. Okay. He's playing. All of a sudden gets a call from his wife. And she says to him, could you do me a favor on the way home? Pick up a gallon of milk. Oh, yeah, honey. No problem. And how's your day? It's going well. How are you doing? I'm at shortstop playing, you know. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, where's it end? It's just...
Well, you said that somebody might make an error. There actually was an error in a Dodger game where they were interviewing, I think it was Kiki Hernandez at third base. I'm not sure, but he made an error.
And was it attributed to the fact that he was talking? Or they said, no, he would have made it anyway.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, you're never going to know.
Right, of course, but... Look, I know you've done a rant about it. I'm not even ranting about it. I just think it's funny. I don't know why they can't wait till they get to the dugout. But, you know, the thing is, maybe you'll have the player say something like, while he's being interviewed, you know, like where he bought his car. Or, I mean, maybe he'll do an advert. Maybe he can do advertising. Oh, and while I'm at first base waiting, if you're waiting, you can go. I mean, it's just.
Well, the ESPN, they take questions from, I guess, Twitter or X or Facebook, whatever, wherever, and they pick one to ask the player. And this one just happened to be about Grimace. Mets have been doing well since they had Grimace throughout the first, but whatever. But I thought that was riveting.
Oh, absolutely. And that is why we need to interview Pete Alonso in the game. And that's going to attract fans to the game. I'm sorry, if you're watching baseball on a Sunday night on ESPN, you're not a casual fan. You put the game on. So it doesn't do anything to my enjoyment of the game to hear him being interviewed. I don't know. Maybe I'm being an old coot, get off my lawn kind of guy, but I'm not ranting about that, but I just, if that can happen, then, you know, let's try and interview one of them for the podcast. So we'll get our money together, 10 grand, and we'll do it. So there we go. There's my observation.
Okay. Thank you very much. And now
it's time for the quote of the week.
baseball is too much a business to them now. I loved baseball. I ate and slept it. But now players, instead of picking up the sports page, pick up the Wall Street Journal. It's different. That is Hall of Famer Satchel Paige. And he said that at the time, it looks like August 9th, 1971.
I would have loved to see Satchel Paige pitch, Jeff.
Yeah. I know.
Watch this documentary, The League. There's a lot about Satchel Paige in there. And then you'll feel the same way. I mean, you do, but you feel like he is probably one of the best ever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, Jeff, you know what? He's maybe not one of the best ever, but he's pretty damn good. And that's Christopher French, who is really doing things with Girls Dad Barbecue. Take a listen.
Connections. That is what the BBQ community is all about. On our episode 236, we had Jeremy Whalen, who was connected to Doug Scheiding. And looking at Jeremy Whalen's Instagram, I found our next guest. He is known as Girl Dad BBQ. And on Instagram, he is connected to another guest we had on, Curveball Whiskey. So we knew we had to contact him. Everyone has a story, and we wanted to hear about his story. He is Christopher French, known as Girl Dad BBQ, and he's from Houston, Texas. Welcome, Christopher.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me, y'all. You know, I hope we can have some fun today.
Absolutely. So, Christopher, I found you on Instagram, Girl Dad BBQ. I also saw that you have a Facebook page. So looking at your Instagram, you have a lot of barbecue stuff. So tell us, how did you get started with the barbecue, and how did you start Girl Dad BBQ?
So I've been cooking since I was about 6 years old. My father grew up learning to barbecue from, believe it or not my grandfather, but my grandmother. My grandmother is a big cook in the family. She does all the barbecue. She was the pit master of the family, you know, cooking on these old drum pits and, you know, watching them to cook as a kid, you know, both inside and out. So when I was about 6 or 7, my dad started having me kind of help out. We're not big measurers. We don't use measuring cups. It's just kind of like feel with love. So I'm a great barbecue, great cook, but not so great of a baker.
Because baking is a precise art. Yes, that's true.
Exactly. And that's where it falls into. Now, when I do bake, I do try to have to kind of get into that measurements and precision, but also it's tough because it's not going into my core, my roots. Flash forward, I'm cooking at home as a kid. I was a latchkey kid, so I was at home when my parents were at work. So we would cook, not cook crazy stuff. Just I'd provide for myself and my sister. My dad and mom would drop us off at this place called Rice Epicurean Market, and it's defunct now. It's gone. And they would have like little cooking classes for kids. And we'd go and do that. They'd go to this neighboring restaurant and have a glass of wine and hang out. And then we'd learn to cook. You know, it was basically a cooking summer camp, essentially, teaching us here and there stuff. Am I a chef? Absolutely not. You know, I worked in restaurants and bars most of my time going through college. And then I was just a guy who liked to cook. I never posted a ton of it. And then when COVID hit, like everybody happened, my real job is I'm in sales. I was on the road. You know, I think the year before that, I traveled, you know, 30 some odd weeks in that year. It was a mess. And then I was stuck at home with a pregnant wife, a young kid. And I was like, well, I'm cooking because she's pregnant. Let me go ahead and start posting this stuff. I was just posting it under my name, my Chris French. And that was it. And then all of a sudden, let's go ahead and let's think of something. I had one daughter. I have another daughter on the way. I'm like, I'm a girl dad. So let's try a Girl Dad BBQ. Thus, like a lot of things are born out of COVID. Girl Dad Barbecue is born out of a necessity and just to keep myself sane.
Talk about being born out of COVID. We started this before COVID, but Jeff and I used to be in the same room. And, you know, sometimes we are, sometimes we're not, but we used to always, once COVID happened, we started using Zoom and great things happened. So the pandemic was a terrible thing, but it definitely changed a lot.
Yeah, I'll say this, you know, yes, terrible thing. You know, the crazy thing is this barbecue community and COVID brought me with people, brought together with people that I had never thought I would even converse with, you know, people from all over the United States, you know, let alone people in my home state, but also California, New York, Pacific Northwest. It's just, it's crazy because I have, you know, my friend group that we, you know, have, has grown immensely. Some people I talk with every day that I never knew until that, but we bonded over COVID and barbecue. So it's kind of a crazy thing.
Now, Chris, you started cooking, you said, when you were six, and not influenced by your dad. Your dad is a home builder. Is that?
Yep. So okay. He's a home builder. He builds multi-million dollar homes. I did not go into the family business. I have a little brother that is doing that, and you know, let him do his own thing. No, yeah. So it's, we were backyard barbecuers. You know, we went on the competition route when I was a kid. We'd ride around with our trailer smoker and go to these little backwoods town nowheres, and we'd be cooking barbecue, you know, for these little small towns.
Now, when you were six, what was the type of cookers you were working with?
So believe it or not, my dad, probably about 6 months before I was born, built a smoker with his buddy, his best friend, and it was a custom smoker. It is still around to this day. It needs to be revitalized, and we've talked about it. So he calls it my twin brother. It's it's the length of a full size single or double cab truck. This thing is a single axle. It probably holds roughly about 18 briskets, roughly, and it's a reverse flow. So my dad always claims that he was one of the first people to make a solid reverse flow smoker on wheels. Although he'll never pat on the back for that from himself, I guess. But you know, it's a one man operation. You know, and so that's what it was. It was a custom smoker that he built. You know, I would love to fix it up, but it's steel is expensive now. Metal is expensive in general. So down the road, probably. But yeah, we had you used to be able to go to local stores and get these barrels that were, you know, they were laid horizontal, cut open half, and just like a clamshell. We've had multiple offsets that I can't even think of all the grills we've had, but that main one was that offset that it's my twin brother. So a little bit bigger than me though.
can you hold 18 briskets?
Oh, I can. I got about maybe 4 to 5 max I can probably hold, but they ain't gonna be cooking. I'll be lugging them around. So, you know, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears has been on that smoker, and it's kind of hard to look at it now and see it in kind of a dilapidated state. And we've been talking about it recently to try to just to fix it up. Let's get it rolling again. It still moves. It's just we got some rusty spots we got to fix.
Did you say you were on the competition circuit?
So we used to do competitions when I was a kid during the summer. We would just kind of roll around. And so we did it when I was a kid. And then obviously the older I got, you know, stuff we had to stop. My dad continued to do it. So he did Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, the big competition down here since he's been doing that since early 80s, early 80s. And then back then it was nothing. Now it's, you know, 300-400 teams.
Sure.
Our last time to get, so I started because you had to be 21 to be there. So I when the rules were a lot more lax back then, we were able to get in there when I was a kid, but then obviously they got a little stringent. So I had to stop until I turned 21. Turned 21. I did it for about 10 years. And then we started having kids. So it was kind of hard to break away from that. So I did it for 10 years. Just that one alone, because obviously with time, it's hard to kind of manage my travel. And also saying, hey, I'm home, but I'm going to leave now and go to this competition or, you know, with kids now. So the best I ever did, my dad was sick. He tried to come out there 1 year. And back then, you used to only turn in one meat. Now you can turn in all three meats now. But now we do – back then, you just did one meat. So I did chicken, one of my best turn-ins by myself at an eighth place chicken out of 147 people.
Wow.
So
pretty good.
That was
pretty good.
Yeah, not too bad. He was scared to death, like, because he's like, you know, you've never done it by yourself. It's always been us together. And we did phenomenal. I mean, it was more of a me and him thing to get out there and have fun. And there were other people there, yes, but like it's a father and son thing. You know, you know, it's very cooking is so primal, and the people that you get to meet out there, because there's pit masters out there you never thought you would meet. One of my last years there, I was sitting at the award ceremony and I ran into Johnny Trigg, you know, pitmaster, rib extraordinaire. And I was sitting there shoulder to shoulder with him, and I'm sitting there and I just bump into him like, Johnny Trigg. Like, and it's just, I can't believe it. Like, he's like, yep, it's me. Like, you know, just so nonchalant. And I met so many people over the time there, but so I stopped doing that when the kids start popping out, and then I started doing it again, but I haven't done one in 2 years. So I started by myself with a buddy of mine. We did it for a couple of years, and then travel got crazy again with work. So I want to get back in it again, but I need my kids to get a little older.
Sure.
I would love for them to come along with me and just kind of see it, experience it, because they love to eat and they love to watch me cook. So I think they'll be great pit masters down the road.
Now, Chris, you're doing Instagram, TikTok videos. You're on YouTube, which, by the way, restoring that that smoker would make a great YouTube video. And you know you'd get tons of views on that.
Yeah, that's kind of a that's one thing I would love to do. And you're right. That'd be a phenomenal thing to do, because it's coming from the like a phoenix rising from the quote unquote ashes.
Right.
And yeah, that's a. It's definitely there. I'd say it's a project in the next 2 to 5 years for sure. It ain't going nowhere. It's still sitting there, and it can't deteriorate any more than it is. But I like the way you're thinking. I may have to borrow that now.
That's you go right ahead. Just kind of mention us in the video.
There you go.
Absolutely.
Chris, I see that on your Facebook page that you have a Kamado Joe as one of your cookers. Is that your sole cooker, or do you have other ones that you use?
So I have a handful. I have seven. My wife says I have eight because we have so many different things. I am a representative or ambassador for the Kamado Joe brand. That's my primary stuff is my Kamado Joes. I've always loved Kamado style cookers. I've used multiple ones. And one of the biggest things, I use them daily. Actually, right before I got on here, I fired up my 18-inch Kamado Joe. I literally just cooked two chicken breasts, one for me, one for the wife. And then I literally pulled them off, set them down, and came and set my chair. Nothing fancy by any means, but chicken breast. And we're going to throw it down with some chicken and dumplings that we had left. Or some dumplings that my mother had made so for the kids. So we're like, mm-hmm. Well, let's just kind of hodgepodge it together. But yeah, I love my Kamados. I have the pellet one as well. That's more my more weekday one. But since it being wet right now, I was like, I'll just fire up some charcoal. You know, it'd be quick and easy.
Ambassador for Kamado Joe. What does that entail?
One of the crazy things is, and it's not like a secret out there, because people, I never want to use the term, influencer, because there's people out there so much bigger than me and have doing this for so much longer. You know, think back of all the people who started out being influencers and being, who are ambassadors of brands. And one of the biggest things is like, I follow those guys. I want to try to mimic them, because we all want to try to be successful like them. A couple months ago, they reached out to me saying, hey, we want to partner up, so to say. So I have to use them exclusively, or at least represent them as an exclusive, because I can't. I mean, there's some stuff I do when I do some larger cooks for catering and stuff like that. I'd need 4 or 5 Kamados. So I do have one big smoker that I use for that. And then I also have an offset from. So one thing people don't know is, I think, and it's not a secret, but Kamado Joe is also Masterbuilt, and also they also are affiliated with Char Griller. So I have a Char Griller offset I use as well for cooking. But so they send you out some stuff, and you have a contract to abide by, and make sure that you are using it and showing it off. I have a griddle from Char Griller, so I use that as much as I can too. That's the biggest thing, is that they want representation of their brand. I had had their their pellet Joe prior to all this, so I knew what there was. I knew what they were. I've cooked on them before. I think the biggest thing is, some people out there take stuff just to give me some free stuff. I want to make sure I'm using it for the right reasons. I want to make sure I'm, getting something that I can use and not just kind of suffer through. So, but that's kind of what they look for. And I mean, I use it anyway. So I'm cooking. I had another Kamado style grill before this one, another charcoal one. I've always used the pellet one. They were like, hey, we'll replace it. I'm like, done. Like, it's something I can use.
So, Chris, I'm looking on your Instagram page, and besides the usual meats, chicken, ribs, brisket, steaks, whatever, anything unusual that you've ever cooked on your grills?
Yeah, I think some of the most unique things, are just like, one of the most things that comes up top of my head is the cow tongue. And Yeah, and it's and if you've never had cow tongue, you almost have to put the stigma away that it's the tongue of the cow. And if you, it's a very Southern Texas tradition. There's multiple ways to cook it. In my opinion, I boil and then I smoke it and then I braise it. Because you can just smoke it and then slice it into slices and put it in tacos. That's great. However, I want mine like almost like shredded beef. So mine's an all day affair. I boil it for 2 hours. I smoke it for about 2 to 3 hours, low and slow, get that nice mahogany color, get that smoke. And then I put it in braising liquid low and slow and just let it go for at least, I want it so tender. When I shred it, I want it to fall apart because the tongue is a very intermuscular piece of meat. I think one of the biggest things that, and to be honest, my wife won't touch it. Like she knows what it is. So she's like, I'm not eating it. My kids will try it cause they're still young. And the flavor is amazing cause you have so much flavor imparted in there from the smoke and the braise. It's like if you've ever had birria style, basically a red fajita flavor, but that rich, rich flavor. And it is a very, like I said, intermuscular. So the fat is a good content. It's very beefy. And if you can get away from the stigma of being a tongue, then that's probably the craziest thing. I think that I cook it regularly. I'm actually going to make one probably this weekend.
Oh, okay. Well, Len, you let me know how it is, and then I'll try it.
Well, you know what, Chris? When I was a kid, for special occasions, we'd get deli platters, and they would have corned beef, pastrami, tongue, turkey would be on there. And as a kid, not realizing what I was eating, I really liked it. Now I can't. I'm the same way. I can't, yeah, knowing what it is, but I know that I like it. I just can't eat it. But it is, and it is good.
It's one of those things. I've had it too. We have a deli down in Houston, which I love absolutely. It's called Kenny and Ziggy's, and I've had theirs. It's a totally different flavor concept. And when I was a kid growing up on it, going into the taquerias, it's like night and day. In my opinion, there's people that want to slice it, and I can't do it. I can't do it sliced. I will. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's still delicious, but I'd rather have that tender fall apart. But once you shake that it is a tongue, I always tell people, try it out. Like it's good. You're going to love it.
Yeah. And it's funny because Jeff is like, Len, you try it. But, you know, Jeff is the more daring one. Jeff ate rattlesnake when he was in Arizona. That's not something that I want to have. So
I've had it before too. It's one of those, it's definitely different. You never know how many bones are in there, cause they're just, you think it's gonna be a purely boneless animal. Obviously it's not, but yeah, we did that in South Texas. We were hunting one time and more times I can count, we run across them when we were hunting, and then you take one out with you and you throw them in the grill with dinner.
There you go. You know, Chris, I'm looking at your link tree. It looks like you have a lot of different brands that you're associated with. And one of them that caught my eye was the Lily Q's BBQ dry rubs. And we had Chef Charlie McKenna on months ago. So, and I assume that you like using his rubs.
Yeah, I do. So actually I listened to that one. So whenever I had to do my research on you guys too, listen to a couple podcasts. And so I travel for work. So I mean, that's one of the ones I listen to because I do like Lily's Q. I actually just got some stuff in the mail through another company that had some of the rubs in it. And it's always good to get something you like, as a little package. So I love their sauces. Their wing sauces are really good. Actually, I feel like with Charlie, he wants it. He's going to do the best in he can because he's not only just a barbecue guy. He was just at Memphis in May. I was talking to him, and in Memphis in May, he's also he's competition restaurateur. He's a backyard guy. Mm-hmm. Like he's all around. So anytime you can have a company like that that's rubs and sauces and seasonings that encapsulate everything in barbecue, which I love and I respect. And he's also just a downhill nice guy. He doesn't shit. He wants to make sure that everyone, gets a chance to touch his rubs and sauces. So, and also sees what he does. Cause I can't remember how they did on Memphis in May, but I think they did. I think they placed in something, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. They did pretty good.
Did you go to Memphis in May?
This year I did not. Two years ago I did. And it was amazing. I was with a different sauce company then. It's called Best Damn Barbecue Sauce. They're based out of Oregon. And the first time ever going to Memphis in May, I was just absolutely blown away. All these, pit masters I ran into, Keith Riles. We were just on the road. We're just on a step from Keith Riles, Malcolm Reed. You know, you're meeting all these people out there. You know, my friends at the Big Green Egg tent, and you know, just absolutely, like I said, the people you meet, you'll never ever think that, you know, the barbecue community is very close knit and very tight. So when I was out there, I was just messaging him, "Who's here? Let's who can I shake hands with and take a picture with?" But yeah, I think my plan is to go next year as well. So I would. It was just an experience. I'm sad I didn't get to go this year. I had a couple of friends go, and they made sure to know that I was that they were there and kind of rubbed my face.
Yeah.
Well, get ready to go to Smoke Slam next year as well, because it's only a couple miles apart in the same weekend as Memphis in May.
Yeah, I had a couple of friends there at Smoke Slam as well. So that's definitely a box to check.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We. Yeah. It is amazing to us as well. Like the people that we get to meet through this show. This past weekend, well, yeah, we were at something called Rib King in Brooklyn. It's amazing because it's an industry city in Brooklyn. They've taken the factories and they've revitalized them and made them now their studios and their restaurants and stores. And right in between in this little section, because you can imagine all these on either side, you've got the tent set up with the barbecue restaurants. They all have ribs, and there's music and there's drinks, and it was a madhouse. It was fun as anything, but it's crazy. And the people online, you know, people are talking about Memphis in May, and we met somebody there. She's wearing a Smoke Slam t-shirt, and it's just, and everybody is just like barbecue, you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah. I want to say I saw a special on Rib King, and I can't remember, it was somewhere on TV, but, and I've seen it before, but I'll have to go back and research this, because I remember this competition, like, or something featured in a expose or something like that. But I mean, that's, hey, at least you're around a bunch of ribs. You can't beat that.
It was great. And our friend Jimmy Carbone is the organizer, and what a job he does. It's unbelievable. He really puts together and then he also does Brisket King. I think he does Brisket King, and then in September he has something called Pig Island.
It sounds magical.
Yeah, pretty amazing. So Chris, barbecue now, you've got the, you know, your social media, but it's still like a hobby, or are you now, is it, you mentioned catering, are you doing it more, is it becoming more of part like a job, or
what? Not yet. Okay. And the reason for that is just because I'm the sole provider of the family. You know, right. I love my job. I'm in sales. I get to talk to people every day. And I deal with the medical side, so I get to deal with a lot of, you know, not just doctors, but I mean everybody from ups and downs of everyone in a hospital. I also get to sell a product that is a good product, where, you know, it's gratification. Mm-hmm. I have a good team with me. So is it a job yet? No. Would I want it to be? I think it'd be a great side gig down the road. I had the opportunity before COVID. A buddy of mine and I were talking about the possibility for a restaurant or food truck or something like that. And then COVID hit, and he's a restaurateur as well already. And he's like, "Yeah, we can't swing it now." So hey, you know what? In the future is bright for Grill Dad Barbecue. I personally love to cook for people, and you know, I think the thing now is just I'm doing a lot of food tastings for some companies around and or businesses. I really want to say there's a couple that are opening up in Houston. So I love doing food tastings. I love doing caterings. It doesn't have to be crazy big, but you know, I love just, you know, I love the call or the text messages or the message or from messages from friends. And they say, "Hey, I have a, you know, 50 person party, you know, I just need some ideas." I'm like, "Perfect. Here's what we can do." And you know, if I can help a buddy out, you know, and make a little something on the side, great. But the big thing is I have to make it bigger. I really want to. Just the other day, we did a food tasting at a place called, and they're expanding in Texas, called Wild Fork, which I think they just opened one up in the Northeast, and they've had a couple, and they're basically an all frozen grocery store. And look it up. It's kind of a cool concept. Everything's frozen meat, seafood. They have pre-made meals. They've got wild stuff too. But my wife and I slung over 150. We made tri-tip tacos and banh mi sandwich, pork belly banh mi sandwiches. it was fun. She had a blast. I think she was probably more tired than I was afterwards because I'm just living off that high of feeding people. But it was great. You know, it's so I think the future is going to be bright. You know, I always say maybe a food truck first, maybe just open 2 days a week and just have some fun with it. We've got some other stuff in plans where we'll be relocating to hopefully some property soon. And that'll give me a chance to have a spot to build that pit, you know, to rebuild it.
Hey, right, there you go. So, yep. Chris, you have three ladies living with you, your wife and your two kids. What are they when they want some barbecue over the weekend? What are you? What's their requests that they want you to make?
So, believe it or not, I actually have four. My dog is a girl, and I mean, you guys were on video, but like, I have all my hair. You know, it is turning gray, but I will oblige for them no matter what they ask for. My wife is a big beef fan, so she is she's a steak, brisket, and my kid, my little ones, my older one, she's not as adventurous. She's just now getting into really liking pork and sweet pork. So she's a big rib person. She's at least I've got her from stop eating, taking the rib with a napkin and holding the napkin to eat the rib to actually eating off the bone now. But my little one, she's about to be four, and she is my meat eater extraordinaire. She can sense it. I'll be preparing a brisket, and she'd sense it. It's like another sense. She just comes in. And it's like, what's that? I'm like, it's brisket. She's like, I want some, and she just senses it when it's ready. So I cook whatever they want me to. I mean, just for lunch today, I had hamburgers. We threw down hamburgers right before the storm hit, and that's what they had for lunch. All three of them had hamburgers. So I will, any request, I'm taking it and they're eating it. So there's not anything they don't, except for like obviously crazy stuff, beef cheek, tongue, frog legs. They won't eat that, but they'll eat the normal stuff.
Now, Chris, you have a lot of videos and I'm always amazed at those TikTok videos because obviously there's so much you're doing. And then it's like, very short videos. But what I was really amazed about was all the different items that you were making, and you were coming up with all different flavor combinations. You made one thing was a sandwich. You took bread and you hollowed it out. You put cheese, you put onions. Then you took sausage. You took the casing off the sausage, spread it out. You put it flat down on the grill. That looked good.
Yeah, that was what they call I'm probably mispronouncing it. Choripan is basically just sausage bread, and it was so delicious. Yeah, and actually one thing about social media and TikTok and stuff like that is you get as much love for every love you get five times the haters, and it's because people are questioning your cooking. You know, is it gonna what are you doing? You did this totally wrong. You know, that was an interesting thing because I remember this thing because it was a cured meat, cured sausage. I opened up and put on there and people were like, oh, that looks raw. I'm like, it's not raw. It's just, it was cured meat. So I'm like, it had some pinkish color to it, but that was probably, it was so good. And like, I think back to that and I actually did another one before, that I didn't post it. I do it just for fun on the side because it's something, it encapsulates everything you want. Bread, onions has some good cheese in it, and then your nice sausage to encapsulate it because you're making it almost like into a little pocket. You're putting everything inside, and the meat is sealing it on the bread. Oh, it was good. It's one of those things. But yeah, you do when it comes to making these videos, you do 45 minutes of, you know, sometimes of work, an hour plus of work, but that, except unless you're doing brisket, and then you reduce it down to 30 to 50 seconds, and your videotaping may be. Of editable amount of work is like 5 to 15 minutes. It's a second job on its own with editing. And am I the best? Absolutely not. But here's the thing: it has to be done because that's what we eat with our eyes first. It's a visualness that we have to bring in to catch that, you know, the person who's watching.
Yeah, you also there were some beef ribs that you made looked mighty fine too when you cut those open. And warning. Do not watch Chris French's videos if you are hungry. That was my mistake.
I mean, it's one of those things. It's and that's it actually gets me in trouble going to the store hungry too. So because I'll go to the store, I need to think of ideas. So I go there, you know, to brainstorm, so to say, and I get in trouble because I end up thinking I'm just going to go there for one product to make, and I end up coming up like six. And my wife, I come home with this stuff. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm going to cook for some content. We're going to eat it all. She's like, you're making six things, you know, like, I'm like, sorry, this is, I was hungry. So that's, right. I know what you mean. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Now, and also, Jeff actually pointed out to me, you have a shelf behind you. It looks like, are those baseballs on that shelf? What's on the shelf?
Yeah. So over here, I have some signed baseballs. My mom was clearing out her house. And she was like, hey, do you want all your stuff? And I said, this is only, I can only, there's liquor bottles and there's baseballs over here. But that's only the ones that I like can keep up there. The rest are down here with some newspaper clippings of baseball. But I mean, I grew up in Houston. Don't hold it against me. I am an Astros fan. You know, that's one of the things it's the team that I grew up with. I remember my first ever baseball game to this day. You know, I was probably, oh gosh, I mean, I couldn't even tell you. I was probably asleep half the time. But, I mean, you know, we were in the old Astrodome that's still standing today. But, you know, and they're all the people I grew up with. There's nobody, you know, Nolan Ryan's up there. I actually have a Nolan Ryan. It wow. should be over. It should be over my shoulder as well. But I took it down because we're about to paint. I have a Nolan Ryan signed picture of a he's actually in the Texas Rangers uniform. But, you know, can't hate on him too much. From
Nolan
that.
Ryan.
Yeah, he stole Nolan Ryan. So I got Jimmy Wynn, the toy cannon, Billy Wagner, a bunch of, gosh, Greg Biggio, Bagwell. I mean, countless Astros from my childhood. So I think it's one of those ones that, and that's just the stuff that's up here. Yeah, there you go.
The Astros came in, well, they were the Colt 45s. They came in the same year as the Mets, 1962. Jeff, we had somebody who wrote a book. Now I can't remember what the book was. Should not bring up something you can't remember, but
David Crowell's book.
Yeah. Right. It was 1962. Right. Wrote this book and it talks all about things that happened that year, but you know, the Mets coming into the league, the Astros, the Colt 45s coming into the league. Yeah. This year you don't have a great team, but
yeah, we're struggling a little bit. You know, it is tough, you know, because especially after the World Series and stuff like that. And then with I think it's more with the Rangers right now and how they did so well last year and losing to them. It was rough, you know, because I have a bunch of friends up in the Dallas area and who are big Rangers fans. So you always get it with the issues the Astros had in the in 2017, 2018. And all the scandal, you get it from everywhere now. But I think it's one of the biggest things. You know, it's baseball. You know, you don't. I feel like somebody. You know, so I always think back when I was a kid. When I remember one of the Houston Chronicle had a tombstone for the Astros' death date, and it was I can't remember what year it was off the top of my head, and they were just abysmal. And then they ended up making it to. I mean, I want to say it was 2007. Now think about it. It was 2007 when they went to the World Series against the White Sox, and then granted they ended up losing that one. And I have a DVD still of that, of the White Sox or the Astros series that year. And that's what it was. Because it talks about this tombstone death date and they made it to the World Series. But that I watched that, that DVD recapping that season. And the moment the White Sox game starts, I'm like, I can't watch it anymore because I know what's going to happen. It was just that was not a good one. So I'll take this year. At least we have some entertainment going on.
Texas is definitely. You got barbecue. You can't argue with that. You got baseball, whether it's the Rangers or the Astros. Texas is definitely a great – Jeff, that would really – Texas could be our home.
Yes.
With baseball and barbecue.
Absolutely. Chris, you know, maybe if you want to take a road trip, I know it's not close to Houston, but Rusk, Texas, there's a guy who has a restaurant who is called All Star Barbecue. His name is Russell Turner, and it is decked out in Houston Astros memorabilia everywhere you can look.
That's cool. So I was actually drove around Rusk last week. Actually, I was in East Texas. So I saw the turnoff for Rusk. That's crazy. I'm going to have to check this out now.
Check that one out. Tell them we told you to go in there. You'll be amazed. We saw the inside of that restaurant. It is unbelievable. Anything that Houston Astros, he has. So
I'm definitely going by there now. Make a side trip for the, well, on the road.
He even has, Jeff, what was that he has the big,
Like an on deck circle, the big Astro logo.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got both Colt 45 memorabilia and Houston Astro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So, Chris, as we end this, could you please let everybody know where they can get in touch with you, your social media, all that fun stuff?
Yeah. Reach out. I'm on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, YouTube, Girl Dad BBQ. I try to put out something new every day. I've been, I think one of the biggest things for me is I want to push the button on barbecue. Texas barbecue is not me. I am a Texas guy through and through. I love my post oak and I love my mesquite wood, mm-hmm. but I love to put a fusion on there. That's my thing is that. So if you want some fusion fun stuff, cooking outside, cooking with your family, see a grown man cry when his daughter wants ketchup for a steak or brisket, come to this guy right here. And I'll see some chuckles in the back end too.
Do you put ketchup on hot dogs?
I'm a mustard guy.
There you go. You could be, you could live here. You could be a New Yorker.
I've been to New York once my entire life, and it was an experience. And yeah, that was, I had a buddy of mine is like mustard, you know, we ran his family, like mustard or ketchup. I'm like mustard all the way. Like it's a great place to visit. We were supposed to go in 2020 with some friends, and obviously that changed different plans, but our plan is to go back with some restaurateur friends and hit it hard. I want to hit New York hard, and that's our plan hopefully next year.
All right. Well, look us up.
Yep. Look us up when you're here.
I'll swing by and drop off a brisket for you guys.
Thank you. All right. Chris, thank you for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. It's been great.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have a great day.
And thank you, Christopher French, for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. He is a fantastic guy. Bring up two girls. He's a girl dad BBQ, and he likes his baseball.
And he has a girl dog, too. So he's
a girl dog, yes. And a girl wife.
And I want to see when he revitalizes the smoker. I really think that will make a great video. So, Jeff, we've done a lot of show.
Yep. And I want to say before we end that people should go to the website fansforthecure.org about prostate cancer. Definitely get yourself checked out. It's an easy blood test. This website's run by Ed Randall, who is a knowledgeable baseball personality. He's on Sirius XM radio on Saturday mornings. So please, you know, take care of yourself. Go in for a blood test and check out Fans for the Cure for more information.
That is a great thing. And we are presented by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. But as I said, we've done a lot of show, but, you know, had a lot to say since we were away. People didn't know that, but they do now. And we're glad to be back watching baseball. You know, Jeff, one last thing. When I was away, so it's a 5-hour time difference, and was looking at the games and things like that, you know, let's say it was like 3 a.m, and I'm trying to see all the scores and everything. And then it's, you know, the games are still in progress. I'm like, how could they still be in progress? It's 3 a.m.
Yes. And one last thing before we go. It happened last week. Mm-hmm. And since Len was away, we couldn't speak about it. But we really want to send our condolences to the family of Willie Mays, who passed away at 93. The greatest ball player, in my opinion, who ever lived. He was the only six-tool baseball player, I think. And he just brought joy to a lot of people. And, you know, I heard people say that famous catch in 1954, that might have been the very first real highlight play because it was the age of television coming up. And so that could be the very first baseball highlight and made it so famous. But Willie Mays is just, you know, amazing. Yeah. And we, you know, rest in peace, Willie.
Yeah. There were people, even over in England, there were people talking about it. So he was, not only was he multi-generational, but he was multi-world or whatever you want to, worldwide.
Multinational.
Multinational, whatever it was. He was. Willie Mays, the Mets retired his number a couple of years ago. We were at that ceremony.
Didn't know it was going to happen. That was,
that's right.
Yep.
That's right. But yeah, Willie Mays, absolutely. You actually have told this story numerous times, but you were at the game. What was his first game as a Met in 73?
72. I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
May 14th, 1972. My father and grandfather took me to the ball game. And so that's Willie Mays. And he hit a home run to win the game. I was 10 years old. And you have a connection too.
Betrayed.
That's right.
I worked with
Charlie Williams.
Charlie Williams, right. I didn't work with Charlie Williams, but I did work with his ex-wife, Bonnie Williams, and which I didn't even know. Somebody said to me, do you realize that that's Bonnie Williams, her ex-husband was Charlie Williams, who was traded for Willie Mays. That's so, right. Yes, absolutely. But I think as much as I loved working with Bonnie, I think being a 10-year-old kid with your father and grandfather at the game and seeing that home run must have been pretty exciting.
Hit it against the San Francisco Giants.
Wow. Which is, I guess, is just.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So
we'll end it there. Len, how are we ending?
We're going to end. Boy, for a second, it's been so long, I almost forgot. But we end with the poet, and that is Shel Krakowski. The musician, Dave Dresser. And the song is Baseball Always Brings You Home. I know it brings us home. And we are so excited that we can't wait till episode 246.
Alive the next day.